From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Welcome to Soundings. Friendship and culture, that's the topic this week on Soundings. My guest is Ronald Sharp, a professor of English at Kenyon College. During a recent fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, Ronald Sharp worked on a forthcoming study about the English poet John Keats and the romantic idea of friendship. Ronald Sharp is also the author of Friendship and Literature, published in 1986 by Duke University Press. Ron Sharp, you're an English professor at Kenyon College, and you're writing about friendship. Why a new book about friendship?
Well, Wayne, as you probably know, the subject of friendship was a great literary and philosophical subject up through the end of the 19th century. And then in the 20th century, for all kinds of interesting reasons, the subject of friendship began to drop out of serious discourse, not entirely, but almost entirely. And I think in recent years, in the last 5 years or so, there's been a resurgence of interest in it, mainly, I think, as a result of issues raised by feminists, by homosexuals, and of course, as a result of all kinds of sociological factors, such as the altered status of the family, the kinds of strains and fractures of the family, have thrown people back on friendship in a new way and with a new intensity.
Well, tell me about this. Why? I mean, how do you nail it down? Do you look at social movements? Do you look, as you trace literary evidence, what do? You look at a novel and say, here's evidence for the decline of what, writing about the concept of friendship? Friendship itself has not declined, I take it.
Well, I think it has. I think it has. And I think that's really the central reason why in literary and philosophical writing, there has been a diminished interest in the subject. There are a number of factors at work. First of all, I think, and centrally, is mobility. What we're dealing with now in modern Western societies is an unprecedented situation where...
So here's something else to blame on the automobile, isn't it?
Well, yes, partly the automobile, the jet plane, and all sorts of other modes of transportation as well. Right. But you've got to remember that for millennia, people grew up in all cultures in a particular place and lived there throughout their lives. So friends were people you were going to be with from the time you were born until the time you died. People would, of course, travel, but the assumption was that you wouldn't be leaving. We're now in a situation where it begins to seem ridiculously obvious that that's not the case, but that's a relatively new fact in the history of the world. So that friendships now take place, they grow, they emerge, they develop and flourish and decay, always in a context of mobility. There is always the assumption that somebody's going to be leaving, taking a different job, taking a different husband or wife, moving to a new city. So that this creates all sorts of strains on friendship. For one thing, people frequently make a desperate attempt to become intimate, perhaps more quickly than it's possible to become intimate in a real friendship, precisely because they know that there isn't going to be much time.
They hear that clock ticking behind them.
Absolutely.
I'm reminded of the AT&T commercials about reaching out and touching someone.
Well, Ma Bell is a shrewd reader of the contemporary scene.
And well, let's talk about the contemporary scene. Hold that for just a moment. But you mentioned your starting point, Ron Sharp, for your discussion of friendship is Aristotle, two writers, Aristotle and Cicero. Give me some generalities about conceptions of friendship then, and then we can come back into the 1980s.
Well, I think we begin with Aristotle with a central distinction that he makes between three types of friendship. Friendships of utility, friendships of pleasure, and friendships of virtue. Friendships of virtue are the highest friendships for Aristotle. Friendships of utility are those that are most commonly seen where one person has something that they can offer another. Usually somebody at work is the best example of this. Somebody that has something for you and you perhaps have something for them. That's a kind of market relationship. And feelings may be just fine, affectionate even, but it's not the deep kind of relationship based on what Aristotle considers virtue that he regards as the highest relationship. Friendship of pleasure is a friendship that we would normally call a sort of buddy relationship today, somebody you have fun with. For Aristotle, though, the defining feature of a great friendship is that it is based on virtue. And this gets us into an elaborate ethical territory that is only now coming back into modern philosophy.
It also has something to do, let me stop you on that for a moment, Ron Sharp. It's genderless, is it not? Aristotle's notion, this virtuous friendship, my recollection is that somehow or other the friendship or the love between a man and a woman, he comparatively devalues in terms of a friendship between two men. Now, is that sexism? Is that ancient philosophy at work with elements that we're unaware of? Help me with that.
Well, certainly from our perspective, it's sexism. The assumption was that friendship between women was simply not possible in the highest sense. And this is Cicero's assumption, and it's Montaigne's assumption. And it's the assumption of most people who wrote on the subject up through the 19th century.
Only men could appreciate this high, virtuous form of friendship.
That's right. Montaigne, for instance, in his famous essay on friendship, says quite explicitly that women are incapable of this. Yeah. They're incapable of the strains of the highest kind of friendship.
Is that because, it may have a sexual dimension to it? I mean, how does he account? Is he simply saying that women are weak and that's that?
That's right, precisely. I mean, it's a sort of... assumption about
ad feminine
between absolutely. Of course, this has changed dramatically now, and this is why I suggested earlier that one reason that there is a resurgence of interest in friendship is that feminists and women novelists, for example, have been writing about the subject in earnest. You have popular novels now like The Color Purple by Alice Walker, Toni Morrison's Sula. Mm-hmm. Which deal directly with friendship. An awful lot of women novelists, particularly women poets like Adrienne Rich, are addressing the subject in a very direct way and in a way that very few men are in contemporary literature. Mm-hmm. You also have a lot of feminist critics and theorists, Louise Bernicau and Phyllis Chesler and Carol Smith Rosenberg and various others, who have been arguing in one way or another, some of these people, that... not only are women suited to friendship, contrary to the ancient tradition, but they're an awful lot better at it than men.
So we've had a wonderful kind of flip-flop here.
A wonderful kind of flip-flop. And I think there's probably something in the claim that women are better at it than men.
All right, and what's the basis for the claim?
The basis for the claim is a very straightforward one, I think, that in one way or another, what all these women are saying now is that women are able to disclose themselves more directly, to relate more intimately, to be more honest with each other, to be more open with each other, that men tend to be very coy with each other. They tend to slap each other on the back and gesture and joke with each other and tease each other, but they're never capable of that sort of direct, straightforward exchange of feelings and emotions that
You just put your finger on it there, the word feelings. The 19th century conception of women focusing, if not primarily, then in large part, upon the business of sentiment and sentimentality. Men, on the other hand, are, you know, the breadwinners. They go out and they bring home the bacon, all of that stuff. Now, again, if we look at women as principally capable of friendship compared to this ancient conception, we have precisely reversed the conceptions.
We have, though the issue seems to me to be more complicated than that. On one hand, it seems to me that women writers who have been arguing this position vigorously are right. Mm-hmm. That is, that kind of direct exchange of feeling, that kind of openness is absolutely central to friendship, and that women in contemporary America are simply better at it than men for all kinds of reasons. However, there are other issues that I think have been ignored in this debate.
What might they be?
And I think they have to do with a conception of form in friendship that seems to me to be a recurrent element in the literature and a really centrally defining feature of the highest friendships. What I'm suggesting here is that there is an analogy between friendship and art in this regard.
You construct it.
Construct a friendship.
It's a deliberate sort of an aesthetic effort on the part of the individual.
That's right. A friendship, it seems to me, is an artifice. the problem is that in the 20th century, particularly in the late 20th century, form and artifice have acquired a bad reputation.
Who do we thank for this? Modern art? I'm only half joking.
I don't think it's modern art. I think it's a whole series of developments that began in the Romantic period that center around a conception of authenticity. There is a sense somehow that form is antagonistic to any kind of real authenticity or sincerity.
It is not natural. It is human.
It's artificial.
Artificial. Okay.
And this notion of artificiality is set against sincerity.
Uh-huh.
One of the keynotes in the literature of friendship from Aristotle through the present has been the importance of sincerity, the importance of openness, the importance of not lying, of being honest with your friends.
Mm-hmm.
And in that regard, sincerity is crucial. But there's another respect in which we've developed a kind of ideology of sincerity. And a good way to get at this, I think, is to think about the California jokes. not only can you have a friendship, but you can have the experience of a friendship. Encounter groups is another way of getting at this. Not to poke fun at these. They're obviously important institutions in many ways. But from the point of view of the history of friendship, they're revealing groups. Because a lot of people join encounter groups because they don't have friends. They fill that function. But there is the assumption in a lot of these groups that somehow you're making contact with your own deepest self, your kind of
rather than with somebody else. Right.
That you're fulfilling needs, you're fulfilling your own needs to become authentic, to become the person that you could be.
Mm-hmm.
But what about the other person?
Yeah, the other person's important in the sense that from him or her you receive the validation that you are seeking, but it is principally an internal kind of process.
That's my sense.
Uh-huh.
So there's this notion that somehow you certify your own authenticity by somehow laying yourself bare, by cutting through all the artificial, phony layers of form and getting to some presumably raw core of your central self.
That's a little scary.
And the attempt has been made in contemporary poetry to transfer this into what has now been called confessional poetry, the attempt to sort of strip open one's emotions, to lay them bare, to attack head-on, as it were, and reveal one's deepest soul. And what happened, of course, very quickly was that this became highly conventionalized. The attempt to break through forms, to explode forms, to circumvent forms in order to get deeper, in order to get closer to the deep reality, quickly became the most conventionalized activity in confessional poetry.
Well, it became a form in and of itself.
In and of itself, exactly the way in the 1960s, for example, and I include myself in this portrait, all kinds of people who imagined that they were rebelling in some way against styles of hair, styles of dress, in effect dressed up in uniforms. One looks at those old pictures of oneself in the 60s, and we're all wearing exactly the same clothes and exactly the same hairstyles, even though we thought that we were being very unconventional.
Right. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You're listening to a discussion about friendship and culture. My guest is Ronald Sharp of Kenyon College. During a recent fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, Ronald Sharp worked on a forthcoming study about the English poet John Keats and the romantic idea of friendship. Ronald Sharp is also the author of Friendship and Literature, published in 1986 by Duke University Press. Here is Ronald Sharp.
Let me give you one concrete example. To me, the dominant model for most people today for friendship is therapy.
Mm-hmm.
We talked about this a bit before when we talked about encounter groups. Almost everybody who has written on friendship from antiquity to the present has talked about the need for friends to share their problems, to help each other out in difficult times. But I think what has happened, unfortunately, to this conception for most people today is that we've gotten very close to the notion of sort of using friends to, as we say, fulfill our own needs.
Mm-hmm.
For somebody like Cicero, friendship did, in fact, fulfill needs. A friendship would always fulfill profound human needs and yearnings. But if that were the motive for the friendship, if that were the animating principle of the friendship, then by definition, it wouldn't fulfill those needs. In other words, the ancient view of this is that you undertake a friendship out of a kind of respect and affection which precedes any simple therapeutic mission.
Uh-huh. We're talking about the other guy rather than yourself.
Precisely. Mm-hmm. And you can see very quickly, of course, how this gets tangled up with 20th century conceptions of and preoccupations with the self. The ancient idea is that I will fulfill my needs only if I don't try to fulfill my needs.
Right.
Another version of this is John Stuart Mill's conception of happiness, where he says after his breakdown, a great crisis in his life, that he suddenly discovered that happiness is not something that one can get if one actively pursues it. It always, it can only be a byproduct of something else.
And we're going to value friendships not on the basis of the friendship itself is reciprocal and collaborative and mutual, but the ways in which we value the friendship are personal and intense and individual. We're not going to talk about, as you say, taking measurements. Have we got this right?
That's right. If you're keeping score,
yeah.
There's no longer gift exchange going on. There's commodity exchange. Uh-huh. Then you've got a sort of cash arrangement going. It's what Aristotle calls the friendship of utility.
Yeah.
And those have their use, but they're not the highest kinds of friendship.
Ron, tell me this. Ron Sharp, you're writing a book about friendship. Where do we look in the late 20th century for what? Models of friendship. How do we get a handle on it so that we can say to ourselves, well, my friend really is my friend, or wait a minute, I need to step back and examine this friendship.
We don't have a lot of models, Wayne. Nothing leaps to mind.
Oh, it's discouraging to hear.
Yeah, there are, of course, treatments of friendship in modern literature, but I can't honestly point to a single one as being a fully significant model.
Well, that takes us back to the problem of friendship.
It does. I think it indicates that friendship in the 20th century has had a very rough go of it. We've talked about mobility as one reason. What we haven't talked about is some peculiar American situations, the sort of democratic aversion to ceremony, the suspicion beginning very early in our culture of anything relating to ceremony on the notion that somehow this was, if not phony, somehow to be associated with tyrannical forms of government that our country was trying to break away from.
Or religion.
Or religion, the sort of puritanical suspicion of ritual.
Yeah.
Put that together with this romantic ideology of authenticity, which leads to a real skepticism about form.
And friendship is in trouble.
And friendship is in trouble. Then you've got the primacy of marriage. Ironically, in light of the high divorce statistics, one reason that friendship has had a hard go of it is that in the 20th century, marriages have been conceived ideally as the place where love, sex, and friendship wonderfully come together.
Mm-hmm.
And it may be worth speculating that one among many complicated reasons for the high divorce rate is that no single institution can support all of those functions.
Are we talking what? About falling short of our expectations? We're hoping for too much? You talk about the institution of marriage and its relationship to friendship.
Well, certainly I think there is a sense among most people now that that the best marriage will be one in which love, sex, and friendship are combined. And this is a relatively new idea historically. So a lot of the intensity that used to go into friendships has gone into marriages. In addition, we have a kind of anxiety about homosexuality and that's still, despite changes in recent years, still rampant in our culture. The silly but widespread suspicion that any close relationship between two men or between two women must, as we say, really be homosexual.
Right.
We have a terrible fear of sentimentality that we inherited from the early 20th century reaction against the Victorians, the sense that somehow or other friendship must be sentimental and not tough-minded. And that has made people very suspicious of friendship as somehow a namby-pamby kind of relationship.
Do you think it's going to survive? You keep giving me all of this terrible negative evidence about friendship in the 20th century. Where is it headed? What you may want to reflect personally, or you may want to talk in terms of the evidence that you're gathering for your book.
Of course, friendship will survive. friendship has survived in every culture. It's had a hard time in recent years, but I think there are a lot of encouraging developments. We talked earlier about the new importance that many people are feeling for friendship in their lives. People, I think, are actively looking now to friendship to fulfill many needs that were fulfilled elsewhere earlier. Ironically, there hasn't been a lot of serious discourse about friendship in light of this new need. What you get mainly are self-help manuals and how to do it books with such titles as How to Be Your Own Best Friend.
Right.
But the other self-help books that have been written about friendship all tend to play off of this therapy model. And here I think there are some serious problems. And this gets us back to this issue of gender that we talked about earlier.
Right.
We were talking about the differences between men's friendships and women's friendships. And I was suggesting that in many ways the central distinction there is that men tend to relate more indirectly and women more directly. Women tend to be more open and direct with each other, more sincere with each other, more confessional with each other. And men tend to do their serious intimacy by means of indirection. Although I think it's true that women, as it were, have the inside line here. That is, that there is something privileged about sincerity and openness in friendship. Well, I think it's true that men need to learn much more from women than women need to learn from men in this regard. There's another side to the story which hasn't been told, and that is that women have a lot to learn from the forms of indirection that men have cultivated. Sincerity is not easy.
Yeah.
Sincerity has become very, very highly conventionalized.
Was it Evelyn Waugh or George Orwell who said that sincerity, even in a suicide note, isn't sufficient?
Sure. there are some wonderful remarks about sincerity in this regard. Emerson and Oscar Wilde come to mind immediately, both of whom, in effect, said in a much more witty way than I can remember that if you want to get the most dishonest remark imaginable, ask somebody to be sincere.
Yeah.
This is something that any autobiographer knows, something that every psychiatrist knows. If you ask somebody to tell you about their own deepest self, they may not be the best person to tell you.
And this is what you mean by the term indirection?
That's right. Men tend to not confess to each other. They tend not to try to strip away the barriers and get down to that raw core of self. They try to do things much more indirectly.
Uh-huh.
And while that often creates serious problems, I think one has to be very careful about glibly assuming that somehow or other the attempt to be sincere ends up making one sincere.
Yeah.
Sincerity, in short, is a form, like all other forms. Just as informality has become a form in our culture. The rituals of friendship in our culture tend to survive in sororities and fraternities. They tend to survive in locker rooms and playing fields. They tend to survive in other corners of our lives that we may not be aware of as well. For example, inviting somebody over for dinner, when couples do this, when married couples, for example, invite people over for dinner. This is a highly conventionalized, highly formalized, highly ritualized activity, and it is a ritual of friendship.
What are you trying to do, kill the dinner party here?
No, on the contrary.
Okay.
On the contrary. I think what we need to do is to begin to see some of the more mundane, what we think of as more mundane features of our lives, like dinner parties and poker games and Monday night football. And
as good ways.
As rituals.
Yeah.
As forms. As ways of dealing with friendship in a formal way that don't seem formal to us precisely because they're operating.
Uh-huh.
Friendship is utterly pervasive in our lives, and that if we look to what apparently are mundane features of our lives, inviting somebody over for coffee, teasing a buddy, we often find that those are the places where forms are being generated, are being created in a culture like ours in which there aren't socially prescribed rituals for friendship.
Ron Sharp, let's conclude our conversation. We've been talking about your book on friendship. Here you've been discussing forms and rituals. That brings me back to the notion of art. Art is something that is, what, outside of us. That's something that we construct. It's something also that we measure. How can we, take a final shot at this? How do we test our friendships in that regard? How do we figure out what a friendship is, who our friends are? Is it possible to run with that for a couple of minutes?
The traditional way of answering that question is to cite one or another version of the common proverb that a friend in need is a friend indeed,
mm-hmm.
that you find out who your friends are when you have a problem.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me, rather, that though that's clearly true in many ways, that the more important test of a friendship is that you find out who your friends are when you find out who can share your joys and successes.
The upside as well as the downside.
That's right. Pleasure, in other words, joy, is undervalued in friendship. This is one of the wonderful points that Cicero makes,
mm-hmm.
partly responding to Aristotle. Cicero says that, in fact, virtue is crucial to friendship. He shares Aristotle's view of that. He says, but it's not all that sober as Aristotle makes it. That is, that one of the key ingredients in friendship is simple conviviality, somebody you like to be with.
Yeah.
One thinks of...
How obvious, but how important.
You think of early childhood
friends
who are imaginary friends. My son Andy, when he was 3 years old, had five imaginary friends that he used to talk about all the time.
Uh-huh.
Very common experience. They're playmates. And it seems to me that a notion of serious play among adults is not an inappropriate one to think about.
This is
friendship.
Homo ludens.
Homo ludens, precisely.
Humanity at play. But we're talking about some deep and serious ground rules.
We're talking about serious play. We're talking about serious play, the sort of play that one has in sports,
mm-hmm.
And also in sex. And I think there's an interesting analogy here in sex and in sports. Somehow, in the best moments, there is a simultaneous excitement
uh-huh.
and relaxation,
uh-huh.
a sense of being at ease and a sense of being on edge.
And no necessary winner or loser.
That's right.
Uh-huh.
And in all of those cases, in friendship too, I would submit, that combination of excitement and relaxation is crucial.
Ronald Sharp is a professor of English at Kenyon College. During a recent fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, Ronald Sharp worked on a forthcoming study about the English poet John Keats and the romantic idea of friendship. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. For a cassette copy of Soundings on Friendship and Culture, send $3 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings would like to hear from you. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Next week on Soundings, the topics will be love, gender, and sexuality in the literature of the English Renaissance. My guest will be William Carrigan of the University of Maryland. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Listen to Soundings. This is Kim Nielsen at the National Humanities Center, inviting you to join Wayne Pond this week for a conversation about friendship and culture. Wayne's guest is Ronald Sharp of Kenyon College. According to Ronald Sharp, there's renewed interest in friendship as a cultural ideal, as well as in its literary expression. Friendship and culture from antiquity into the modern world. Some answers and insights this week on Soundings from the National Humanities Center on this station.